Welcome to Losing My Religion, a podcast for and maybe about you. This is Joe Armstrong, author of Joe the Human Substack, J-O-E, the Human, H-U-M-A-N, Substack, S-U-B-S-T-A-C-K. Google that and you'll find me online. Today's podcast is a very special one. It isn't every day you publish a memoir, but I've published two. And this podcast is a slightly edited edition of the launch of my second memoir, Saved by Woman, which is published in the memoir series Losing Religion, Finding Myself. The first one was In My Gut, I Don't Believe. As with the first memoir, the book launch was a Zoom event and chaired by Eamon Murphy, a humanist celebrant. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. I shall hand you over now to your host and mine, Eamon Murphy.
Welcome, everybody. Very good evening to you. And thanks so much for joining us this evening for a very special event. My name is Eamon Murphy. I'm a colleague of Joe's at the Humanist Association. And this, as you know, is a virtual launch of Joe's new book. Joe Armstrong is very many things. He's a journalist, a podcaster, a radio documentarian, a lyricist, a blogger, a humanist celebrant, as he reminds me more frequently of late, he is a human. And most pertinently this evening, he is an author. And he's already published one excellent memoir entitled In My Gut, I Don't Believe. It was reviewed at the time by A.C. Grayling, who described it as a fascinating, courageous and moving account of an individual leaving the trammels of religion, with the good light of humanism, an educative story on many levels well told. And In My Gut, I Don't Believe told the story of Joe's life up until the end of the 1980s and revolved predominantly around his time spent in a seminary in Dublin preparing for priesthood before leaving prior to ordination. The Irish Times review of the book called for volume two, please. And here it is, 3 years later, which isn't bad scheduling, given that Joe is not a full-time author. His new book, which we're here to discuss tonight and to launch, picks up where the first book left off, and is part of a memoir series entitled Losing Religion, Finding Myself. But on to the reason that we're all gathered here this evening, but a bit more about him. He was a weekly columnist for the Irish Times for 7 years, and while he was the commissioning editor with the academic publishers Peter Lang Limited, he co-founded the still-thriving Reimagining Ireland series, now more than 100 volumes, and he's been married for more than three decades now to Ruth. Have a son and a daughter in their 20s, I believe. I hope I'm getting that right, Joe. And as I mentioned, his new book picks up where the old one left off. It's called Saved by a Woman. It falls to me to encourage people to buy the book. And the easiest way to do that is on Amazon. We're going to get a taster for it now in a moment. Later this year, we hope that that'll be available in audio format as well, narrated by the author himself on audible.co.uk. At the moment, it's available in hardback. And we're going to begin the discussion on Saved by a Woman, the reading from that book. So I'll hand it over to you, Joe. If you'd like to introduce that particular episode or chapter and give people a first taste of your new biography.
Thank you very much, Eamon. And thank you all for being here. It means a lot to me. I asked Eamon to choose which pieces he would like me to read. So he chose two. So each episode is about 800 words. So this one, just to give you a bit of context, I'd spent 9 years studying for the priesthood, and then I took leave of absence. But the leave of absence meant I was actually still a marist, still a student for the priesthood, and I could have gone back because I was still a member of the congregation. And the question which faced me was, well, was I going to go back, or was I going to decide not to go back and just to leave? So Eamon has asked me to read this chapter because it is a very significant chapter in that part of my story. And this is the year I'd left the Marists, well, not left, but I'd gone on leave of absence in June 1989, and it's now April 1990, which is a ridiculously long time ago. Anyway, by the 30th of April 1990, I had decided to leave the Marists, but I wanted to live with the decision for a while before confirming it even to myself. There'll be quotes in this in my journal, because I've lots of journals, and I keep quoting from. So I quote from a journal: "I believe the major period of disintegration has passed and a new period of construction and new life has begun. I journaled, I no longer wanted, quote, the defence shield intellectually and sexually of being embarrassed. And after a dream on the 4th of May, I journaled, what am I afraid to jump into? Life? On the 6th of May, I explored upward movements of construction and direction emerging from the cauldron. The first was my insight that I had manipulated my life to reduce my personal freedom. The second was that I booked myself for an assessment with career analysts in London. It would test my interests, background, skills and aptitudes, followed by an interview with a career analyst, and I would receive a personal written report. The third waft from the cauldron, now the cauldron was an image that I used for making my final decision, was my writing career. Initial steps already taken, I posted profile and satire yesterday, will contact by midterm if I hear nothing. I can't recall what I'd written or to whom I'd sent it, but I was writing. Fourth, I was making progress in spiritual direction. Fifth, socially I was casting aside the armour, being vulnerable. Sixth, I was fairly confident that I would receive qualified teacher status by August. On the 8th of May, I scribbled into the dark, into the cauldron, the bubbling, boiling cauldron. I came to London to make a decision. Shall I leave the Marists? Once that decision is made, what would keep me here? I wouldn't leave London until I had acquired qualified teacher status. It would be a useful professional status to attain, ensuring good income and security through life. But did I want to teach? On the 13th of May, I journaled, I don't feel enthusiastic about teaching. What do I want to do? Days later, I added, it is sensible to stay in teaching at least until next January, when my probationary year ends, and probably until September 1991. You're probably thinking to yourself, this guy is procrastinating rather a lot. It's my middle name. I journaled on the 27th of May. I realise now that given the continued sexual relationship with Chloe, I have effectively cast aside the Maris defence armour. I'm sowing wild oats, which is part of what I wanted to do. Career analysis was on the 29th of May, a month since my decision to leave. Next day, I wrote confirmation of decision. I wondered if it was time to write to the Marists, my family and friends, to let them know. I journaled, I feel numb. At least I'm sure that this is my decision. It's an act of trust in myself. Even my worst enemy wouldn't accuse me of a rash decision. It has taken 10 years. I was afraid of stepping into the dark. I need to work at a personal project that I believe in. That's how I get a buzz out of life. I need a reason to get up in the morning. My temperament is incompatible with the vow of obedience. I have no guarantee of working at something that would marshal my creativity, initiative and dynamism within the Marists. Even if I found such work within the congregation, there's no guarantee, given obedience, that I'd be allowed to do it, or do it immediately, or for as long as I'd want to. After some tests and an interview, the professional career analyst confirmed in three words what it had taken me a decade to realise. He said, it's not you. It's not you. Oh, so he said. I journaled. When I jump out of the Marists, it is an irrevocable, irreversible decision. Take the risk. There may be barbed wire hidden where I jump to. Accept it may hurt. It's part of the thrill of being alive. On a page of my journal, I drew a picture of a cauldron, complete with flames licking its surface. Inside the pot, one ingredient was to cast aside the imaginary Joseph and learn to be my body, my mind, my judgments. Other ingredients were the fragile emergence of my ego and my decision-making. A core ingredient was re-emergence of freedom, freedom's triumph over self-manipulation and inauthentic security. The final ingredient was to stop playing games, choose authenticity over artificiality, and make-believe. Outside and above the cauldron, like a good aroma, were three spurs. The first was leave the Marists. The second said teaching short term. The final one said get writing, go for it. And underneath the picture I wrote, simmer for 3 weeks.
Thank you, Joe. And get writing you certainly did, albeit after a little bit more procrastination.
Lots more.
When we were preparing for this evening, I suggest that particular one because of the element of self-examination that it contained, a certain amount of inner turmoil about your future that was present, and because all of that characterized what a lot of the book is about. But while people will be able to maybe hazard a guess at the general content of this second memoir from hearing that, from seeing the title of the book and the cover shot on it, and knowing where you left off from your first book, at the same time, you might like to give people more broad detail maybe about what's contained in the book, and maybe as well why you feel compelled to write it and write it relatively soon after your first memoir.
Well, Eamon, you're partly to blame because you encouraged me to write another one, and other kind people also, not to suggest that those perhaps the kindest of all would be would you ever stop writing, Joseph, but anyway, people did. And the fact that, as you mentioned, Eamon, the Irish Times Review finished volume two, please, it was encouraging. And I had all of these journals and I thought, well, you know, if you want to write something particular and original, then, you know, there's nothing more original than that, because it's nothing else, nobody else can write it but me, because I've written the journal and it was my life. I also wrote it, though, both books, because I genuinely wanted to understand myself better. I'm deeply persuaded by the Socratic dictum that the unexamined life is not worth living. And by writing both memoirs, it has helped me to examine my life, to figure out how I transitioned from such a believer that I even wanted to be a priest to not believing in God or an afterlife. And I thought, well, that's a kind of a big transition to make in a person's life. How did I make that transition? And I guess what I've learned from the second book was, because the first book finished with this moment of deep realization that in my gut, I did not believe, and how scary it was to actually trust that feeling from my gut. And then the second book, I was trying to figure out how quickly did I change my way of thinking, but it took me a long time. And as you heard me read, you know, I was still thinking in terms very much of God and religion, because it was part of my makeup. It was how I had been brought up, and it was the only way that my brain was wired.
Is it the kind of book, given the emphasis on understanding yourself, understanding how your thought processes, for want of a better label, changed over time, was it the kind of book that you can only write at a very far remove? You mentioned at the beginning that 1990 is an awful long time ago. It's hard to believe, given that a lot of us probably have memories of what happened that summer out in Italy. What was it like looking back on those times? And given all the life experience you've accumulated since, to a certain extent, was it maybe like writing about somebody else? Did you recognize the man in the narrative?
I think, like, when I, you know, I quote a lot from my journal, but when I'm writing my journal, and I still write my journal, it's very private and I'm writing it from my eyes only. And the fact that I'm kind of have the courage to include stuff from my journal of 30 years ago or 40 years ago, it is because at times looking back, it's like, oh, well, that's a totally different person. And so the distance does give me the freedom to say and to share stuff that I wouldn't have dreamt of saying or sharing or writing, let alone publishing or reading out, you know, at the time, because it was very, very, very personal. And it still is very personal, but because it's 30-ish years ago, it's easier.
You're at that point in your life, you mentioned you're still referring to God, you're still, religion still colours your worldview to a huge extent. And there was parts of your previous memoir where you kind of exhibited, I guess, attitudes of general intolerance towards people who didn't share your Catholic faith, to the point where you kind of wished that some of them would leave Ireland altogether.
True.
And we've all held views in the past that we look back on now with a certain amount of embarrassment.
With horror.
Yeah.
You're referring to the fact that, like, as a teenager, which is a rather long time ago, but it was nevertheless me, as a teenager, I had this row, turned into a row, with a pupil, a fellow pupil. And I was sort of so convinced that all this God thing was so right. And, the God knew the best way for everyone. And I thought, well, if people don't see what is clearly the case and true.
All that aspect of you, when you look back on it now, how much of it is, oh, geez, I can't believe that was me? Or how much of it is, look, that was just part of my journey to where I am now. You are the man you are now, and your childhood, obviously, you played a massive part in that. Your journey plays a massive part.
Listen, I can tell you worse than that. Well, maybe it isn't worse than that. No, it is kind of worse than that. When I was studying theology, I was on the student council. I think it was vice president or something of the students' union. And off we went to the youth, Union Students of Ireland conference, annual conference. And I argued, that women should not have the right to abortion. But I'm utterly appalled by that earlier position that I held, because I know for a certain fact, even though most people won't agree, that if men had babies, abortion wouldn't even ever talked about. But I was one of two people, the other guy was a Jesuit, and we're the only two people at the entire conference that spoke, oh no, abortion is all wrong. Everybody else wanted to, allow women the freedom to control their own bodies. So yeah, I'm appalled by that, but that's what changes and growth and learning.
And in as part of that change and growth in learning, there was a time at which you looked at the prospect of a career in teaching as sort of as a handy backup, I suppose, something which would give you, you mentioned it actually in that particular episode you read out, a guarantee of financial security for the rest of your life. Was that always sort of considered to be kind of a, like I say, a backup plan, a worst case scenario, but it's not what you feel your calling is?
This is with apologies to Tim Reardon, because Tim was, where's Tim? I can't see Tim, but I know you're there. Tim was a student whom I taught at Bonaventure School all those years ago. And one of the beauties, sorry, I'm going off a little track here, but one of the beauties of writing a memoir is reconnecting with people. And I'm so, so grateful that I have been able to reconnect with people whom I'd lost touch with. Hi, Tim. What was the question again?
I suppose what I was getting at was how early on in the process, after having left the Maris and trying to figure out what it was you wanted to do with your life, that you decided you wanted to be a writer. Writing and thinking was going to form the big part of your.
Well, when I was in the seminary, I wrote, did a little romantic fiction piece, which wasn't actually fiction at all, but I didn't tell Gay Byrne that. And the buzz, that's the only word for it, the buzz I got out of hearing words that I had put on a page read aloud by a professional actor, it just blew my mind. And I thought, that's really what I want to do. So I would have always loved to be, but when you're starting to be a priest, you have to follow the party line. I thought, a writer can't follow the party line when it comes to Catholicism, because there's so many things you can't say or believe or express or whatever. So, I mean, faith and religion was an utter constraint on my desire to be a writer. And I never wanted to be a teacher. I wouldn't have considered becoming a Christian Brother, because that's what they did. They taught. And I thought, what's the point of having a vow of obedience and celibacy and poverty in order to teach? And there were a gazillion teachers in Ireland at the time. There was no shortage of lay teachers, brilliant lay teachers. Lots of them here today. So I just, why would you want to be a priest to teach? Or a Christian Brother to teach, couldn't get it. But then when I left, I obviously needed to earn a crust. And while I did serve wonderful cappuccinos in BHS in Oxford Street and put up with the abuse of various obnoxious people who came, difficult customers, you're always going to get a difficult customer. I marvel at those who have the patience and the skills, which I clearly lack, to deal with the general public in that way. So, but yeah, I always wanted to be a writer. And as a teacher, I wanted to be a writer, but was a procrastinator extraordinaire.
You kind of alluded to it a little bit there a few moments ago, reconnecting with people as you write a memoir. It's one of the great things about it. I'd be very interested to hear a little bit about your process for writing. Now, you are blessed with a wonderful habit and have been from an early age of keeping copious journals, which obviously helps. Sometimes when I go back and read old emails that I've sent 15, 10 years ago, whatever it is, I marvel at how my thoughts on things have changed without me even realizing it. But you have a mechanism by which you can actually track how your worldview, your paradigm and life changes. I mean, aside from all of that, aside from the process of meeting people to discuss events that you might be including them in your memoirs, what's the whole process of actually writing such a book like for you?
Well, I guess I start off by reading my old journals for the period, and then I try to sketch the main theme so I have a structure, turning points and so on. And then I start to write it, and then I give it to my editor-in-chief, Ruth, who's sitting right beside me, without whom nothing would ever get published. Yeah, so that, and then of course you write and you check and you rewrite and you get it better and so on. Do you know what I'm thinking of? We did mention to people about music, and we haven't done any music yet.
Exactly what I was thinking for next. Now, well, do you want to explain why we have a piece of music coming up, first of all, maybe?
Yeah, firstly, can I explain? I write songs. I'm very happy. There are two musicians in this room. Well, I'm sure it may very well be more. But Andrea Petron, Andrea, can you reveal? Can you? I don't know. I can't see you at the moment, Andrea.
Hello, everybody. It's me.
Hello. Hello, Andrea. How are you? Oh, Paul has raised his hand. Sorry, I must take this because Paul has raised his hand. Paul is my brother, and he's my only brother.
Hello.
Oh, he's just saying hello. Hello, Paul. Or did you want to say something, Paul? Nope, that's fine. Paul, that's fine. Andrea, I can't see you, but I'm sure somebody can.
I can see you.
Okay, great. So Andrea and Brian Matthews, who goes under the name The Rain, or A-Y-N-E, we three write songs together. And Brian was going to sing tonight, but his wife became ill today, and she's in hospital with acute pain. So he cannot be here. But happily, one of the songs that the three of us have written together is recorded. And equally happily, Andrea has a trumpet, even though I can't see. Can you see Andrea have that trumpet?
Yeah,
he's going looking for his trumpet. Andrea, do you have your trumpet?
Yeah, it's here.
Oh, it's good.
And
so.
Sure.
What we're going to do is, because Aunt Brian isn't here to sing live, which is what we were hoping to do, but we do have Andrea. So Andrea is going to give us a blast with the trumpet. And while he's doing that, I'm going to try to figure out the technology. So we will play the song which we wrote together, one of two songs which we wrote together. And this song is an engagement song. And it's a song which I'd forgotten all about, but which I came up with the basic melody and lyrics for this 10 days after I proposed to Ruth. So how's that? So we're going to get a blast from the trumpet, please, Andrea, and I shall try and figure out.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for everybody. Thank you, Joe. So this song is written by Joe Armstrong, Andrea Patron, and Brian Matthews, Every Moment. And then we play a little bit introduction with my trumpet. Thank you.
And now I'm going to try and do the technology bit. So bear with me. I have to share my screen, don't I? Share screen, Joseph. Don't get this wrong.
Every moment of every day, I will love you forever. Every moment of every day. every moment of every day. I will love you forever.
Can we have a big clap for Andrea and Lorraine?
If anybody wants to listen again, in internet is available on Spotify and all streaming platform.
Andrea Patron, you can see his name there, A-N-D-R-E-A, A-N-D-R-E-A, Patron, P-A-T-R-O-N. And I think on Spotify, Andrea, you're Patron Andrea, am I right?
Yeah.
Andrea Patron, wonderful name. And Andrea is an Italian in Estonia, and yeah. Brian is in the UK, in Leeds. So we collaborate online, R-A-Y-N-E. Give him a like. We are going to do another song later on, and it has never been heard before, and I have never heard it without getting all weepy. So please, if you're tempted to go away, just don't, because we're going to play that for the first time in public later on, okay, before we finish tonight.
We're going to make Joe Armstrong cry.
Yeah, you're going to make me cry.
Just to say, Joe, there's already some comments into the Q&A. Niall is congratulating you on the song. Really likes it. So do Sean and Keane. And we have our first question of the evening, which we might go to after. I think we're planning to do a second reading at this point. So we might do that. And I might cede the floor to people if they have questions or comments they might want to make at that point. But Dara is already in with the first question in the Q&A.
Okay, so I'm going to just do the second reading. This is like Mass. I'm doing the first reading, the second reading, then we'll have the gospel. No, we won't. Sorry about that. I don't mean to offend anybody. I'm going to read this. Stop talking and read this. Here we go. A German friend and former Jesuit wrote to me on 29th March 1992, about 2 years after the last reading I did, telling me the happy news that he was about to become a father. You can imagine how proud and happy we are. We've prepared the cradle. It's the cradle in which I slept as a baby. How's life with you? Are you still doing some writing? And instead of writing, I did a retreat at Stanbrook Abbey. A retreat at Stanbrook Abbey. I wasn't a humanist then, was I? Run by Benedictine nuns. On Palm Sunday, the 12th of Palm Sunday, see, I was following the liturgical cycle. The 12th of April, I journaled the black hole of writing. All I've got to go on is to sit down, stay here, keep at it and wait for something that works and build on it. I journaled, oh yeah, it's time to get on with life, to live in the present, to accept myself as I am. And I hope that my wife would accept me as I am. And God, you see, God language, God accepts me as I am. He redeems me as I am, not through the denial of aspects of myself, but by taking every inch of me, loving me and redeeming me. Let me then boast of my weakness that I may sing of God's mercy and glory. You see, I hadn't lost religion at all, but I'd moved on. I accept England as my home for today and for however many todays that might add up to. Home is an inner reality. Home is within me. And then on Spy Wednesday, I journaled, I've resolved nothing. I'm like a tiny cork or alga in the midst of an ocean without direction and without a healthy sense of who I am, too open to suggestion and persuasion, rudderless and lacking an anchor. I feel barren, hollow, so much energy, creativity, anger and passion. How can I decide what to do? By Good Friday, the eve of my 30th birthday, I'm now nearly 62, I had arrived at New Hall, which is the boarding school where Ruth worked, for the Easter Triduum, like a good and holy Catholic. Ruth is lovely, I journaled. I enjoyed eating with her sister Stephanie, but us sitting together, I wanted to touch Ruth. I enjoyed the dance of our eye contact. Our conversation, she's very embarrassed over her chair, I can tell you, she's nearly got to run out. And fun and laughter. I might suggest to Ruth that we meet sometime next week or go on a hike or ramble. What? She said something. Okay, keep reading, Joseph. I'm still that alga on the water. I can hardly see this, except I see it more positively now. Having thought about it and shared it, I can see it as my essential self, as one point me free of falseness, as a part of me made by God. See, there you go, still religious. And it is closer to the it's closer to the water now than I imagine myself in a big boat or a ship, even closer than when I thought of myself paddling in a solitary canoe. Sister Stephanie thought I was seemed open and free, and she sensed my anger and hurt. 4 years since I had done a retreat. 3 years since I went out on leave of absence. 2 years since I decided to leave the Marists. Just a little over a year since receiving my dispensation from my vows, as I was finally professed. I had to apply to the Vatican to allow me to get on and do my life. I thoroughly enjoyed the meal and mass tonight. I had a beautiful moment with Ruth. We were alone in her flat around midnight on Holy Saturday. She offered me a biscuit from a packet of chocolate biscuits. It was her present to me on my 30th birthday. That tiny act, my best ever birthday gift, but apologies to anybody else who's given me birthday gifts, but it was my best ever birthday, felt somehow like sealing the deal with chocolate. She knew I was interested in her, and by that tiny gesture, in that moment, she communicated that she was interested in me too. At 2:40 a.m. that morning, alone in my bedroom at Newhall, I journaled. A great Easter. I'm so glad I did a retreat at Stanbrook and the Triduum here at Newhall. It has been time, quality time, very well spent. P.S. Ruth. When I returned to Ilford, I told Ken all about Ruth. He reached for a CD by the Waterboys and selected and played one track for me, A Man Is in Love.
That's for that reason, Joe, that I can never hear the Waterboys now without thinking of you. So, for good or ill. I'll ask you one more question before throwing things open to the floor. It's in relation to something that you alluded to in the first reading. I guess it's related to the second one, given that that's not the episode where you meet Ruth, but it's the episode where things begin their momentum to where towards where they ended up. And what I was very curious about was reading the book and noting your lack of faith in yourself, your lack of faith in your own ability to sustain a relationship, or to even think that at times, even to think that a woman would want to be with you. And I'm just wondering, be any closer to understanding where that came from, and what was it? Was it true your lived experience, you know, the humanistic process that you came to realize that really wasn't the case at all?
It's a daily marvel to me that Ruth is still married to me. You know, I've no doubt about it that was one of the reasons I entered the seminary, because I just thought, well, sure, nobody would want to marry me. And perhaps it was to do with my background. It was an unhappy family. It was a dysfunctional family. And my mother and father, as I thought growing up and as I see it looking, you know, I don't think it was a very good relationship. But that's my judgment of it. So it didn't inspire me that marriage would be a great way of being happy in life. I'm going to leave it at that.
Okay. Well, look, I don't plan to chair passing on messages from the floor. I think it's much better if this is a more conversational discussion, and that in mind, I'd invite Dara Hogan, who is the first person who sent a question into the Q&A, to unmute himself if he would like to actually ask his question directly. Is that okay, Dara?
Yeah, there we are. Will I do it now?
Fire ahead.
Yeah, quick question. Joe, with your knowledge of theology, and I have little or no knowledge of theology, is it reasonable that our universities still have faculties of theology alongside faculties of science? And is there a case that they should be closed down, or maybe we should retain them and have a big focus on unbelief as well as belief inside the theology faculty. What's your thought there?
Well, it's a very good question. I do have a degree in theology, and I'm really glad that I did a degree in theology. So I would absolutely not want a theology department closed down in a school. I know some people don't see it as credible or whatever, but I'm very glad I did it. And quite frankly, it helped me in my unbelief. You know, when you read, I could talk about this for a very long time, but I now have an informed unbelief. It's not just I don't believe in all that stuff. You know, I have studied the scriptures, and I have read the history of the church, and I have read the doctrine of the Trinity and you know, the papal infallibility, and I understand them, and I understand the party line, and I also find it marvelous that people can enter a seminary, which one has to assume is wide open, and yet they all come out the other end of it like a sausage machine, all being Catholics, or all being Muslims, or all being Anglicans, or all being whatever, you know. And you kind of think, well, you know, to what extent was that a genuine pursuit question of knowledge? But no, I am very glad that I, you know, the fact that there is no resurrection story in any of the Gospels that we have, that the bits about the resurrection were added like many years after the events. And this was before people could write properly and record things and had evidence. How reliable is that? You know, the earliest canonical gospel, Mark's gospel, earliest form of it, has no account of the resurrection. I know that because I studied theology.
Okay, thank you for that. Thanks, Eamon.
Thanks, Dara. PJ, I think it's PJ Keneally. Would you like to unmute and ask the questions that you put in the Q&A there?
Yes, thank you, Eamon. Good evening, everybody. Hello, Joe, and congratulations on your second book of memoirs.
Hello, PJ, how are you? Thank you for being here.
My question is, I'm of the vintage that grew up with the term mother's vocation, a mother's vocation. Did you ever think or question as to whether or not it was your mother's vocation you had? Because you didn't have a vocation, sorry, yes.
Well, it's a very good question. Like, I don't believe anybody has a vocation, you know, with respect to those who, like, you know, Dan Dennett has this thing, and I'm sorry if anybody is offended by this, but I genuinely, like, when I decided that that it wasn't for me, like, simultaneous with that decision for me was, it's all a load of, I just can't believe it. It is made up stuff. And so in coming to my personal judgment, which I admit is a personal decision, that there's just no truth to this. It's founded on lies, a very big lie. And, you know, there's not any part of me that believes that any professional religious person is doing other than, you know, I'm not saying that they're personally lying, but I think that they might still believe in a big lie. But I do genuinely believe it's all nonsense. I mean, there's so many thousands of religions throughout history. And the idea that this relatively recent one of 2,000 years of, you know, it's only 2,000 years old. Anyway, I'm rambling and all that kind of stuff. I don't know if that, did that answer your question? I can't even remember your question, PJ.
Yeah, my question was mother's vocation. Did you ever?
Oh, mother's vocation. Sorry, I totally didn't answer your question, did I? mother's vocation. Well, to the extent that when an infant is born into a Catholic family, well, let's just talk about me as an infant born into a Catholic family. My mother was hyper-religious, unquestioningly religious. She never had a doubt. Like, even as a kid, I found it embarrassing, you know, watching her looking at, and I have this scene about that in the first book, looking at the picture of the Sacred Heart. And as a kid, I'm looking and thinking, she can't be serious. But you get drawn into it. And I was drawn into it. And you get drawn into it because of the time I was born. I was born in 1962, and it was a very different Ireland. I was born into a very religious Ireland, very religious family, very religious mother. Like, as an infant and as a child, you believe everything your parents tell you. And so that was a huge part. Now, I don't think that I joined the seminary because, you know, my mother had a vocation or she wanted me to be a priest. I genuinely don't think that's the case. I know men who, probably 20 years older than me, who would have gone to seminaries and it was their mother's vocation. And when they chose to leave, the mother wouldn't talk to them because, you know, she was appalled. that they were leaving the priestly path. That wasn't my experience at all. In fact, I never actually knew whether my mother was happy or unhappy that I was there.
Okay, thanks, Joe.
One thing that I remember, Joe, from reading, and I'm not going to go digging for the exact quote, but I'm almost certain your mother sent you a letter shortly after you informed her of your decision to leave the Marists, which, to paraphrase, accepted it as probably the right decision for you.
Yeah.
In that you had reached it yourself, and, you know, so she didn't come across as embittered, at least in that correspondence.
No, I because I know, you know, my mother was difficult, and she was difficult. Hi, Paul, you know that. It's really difficult to you. Huh? Is he? I can't see you, Paul, but you're there. Yes. And I'm really glad you're here. And you could tell stories that I can't tell because, you know, I was an infant. And oh God, I've lost my thread again. What was I saying?
I suppose it was just in relation to your mother's attitude towards your
leaving. Oh yeah, I know what I was saying, because you mentioned letters. No, she was actually, her letter to me when I finally wrote to her and told her I was leaving was actually very kind. And it was very understanding. And she, you know, she was talking about my courage. And I have to say, you know, some of the letters I got from the Marists at the time were the opposite. Now, some of them were lovely. Some of the letters I got from the Marists were lovely. But some that I got from people that I, you know, some hurt a lot.
Well, I'm going to ask John O'Sullivan, speaking of the Marists, to unmute himself.
Sean of the One Eye.
Hi, Joe, can you hear me?
I can, John. Thank you for being here.
Joe, so I read the book a few months ago, and I met you there a few weeks ago, and we didn't actually talk about it, partly because I think my wife was there and she hadn't read it, so it would have been like she would have been out of it or whatever. But you've refreshed me tonight on the book, and a few things strike me about it. One is, first of all, when I look at the screen here, the demographic that we're looking at, that a lot of people here are of a certain age, and that the book is of its time. In terms of, like, even when I was teaching for 10 or 15 years or whatever, the kids could hardly even understand the whole religious concept, the whole religious culture that I was coming from. So their kids are another generation away from it. So, like, for a lot of people reading your book, would it be like them reading about that sort of Orthodox Jewish woman in New York who eventually escapes to Berlin to be an actress or whatever, but just less exotic? So because of that, I'm thinking, the book is for people of a certain age. And then is there a universal sort of part to it that would appeal to younger people? So I want to say to you is that I think the part that struck me the most in a strange way, I suppose because I know the religious part and, you know, like, I've lived it.
You certainly do.
Yeah. Was your whole exploration of your sexuality and that whole idea of the continuum of heterosexual, homosexual, sort of where am I, how do I fit in, and how it's not that clear. And just to praise you, I suppose, but also your wife, in terms of having to read that and not be threatened by it. That's what struck me a lot about that could apply to a lot of young people today, as well as the people of our age, you know, about the churchy stuff and all that. Life is sexuality is a very strange thing and very unclear, and then we eventually go for something, and, you know, that's it. But so I really applaud you on that level, that I found that very interesting, revealing, vulnerable, and all that. My main question, though, sorry, long-winded, was the name of the book, Joe, Saved by a Woman. I was thinking, and my wife said this to me, she said, imagine if a woman wrote a book called Saved by a Man.
Well, I have a sense of humor. I have a sense of humor, John. Sorry, you hadn't finished your question. Go ahead.
I haven't finished. So I'm just wondering, like, that'd be, are you undervaluing yourself again?
Oh, thank you.
I'll
take that.
Saved by a woman. Rather than being saved by Jesus, you're now being saved by another person. Whereas ultimately we have to save ourselves, really, don't we?
Yeah,
and we bring ourselves to a relationship. Improves us, but it doesn't actually save us as such.
Yeah.
So I'll just put that out there. I was shocked by the title, I suppose.
You're shocked by the title. Well, I do have a sense of humor, and so, firstly, okay, what was in my head would say, but with the title, firstly, there's this magnificent song by Ray LaMontagne called Trouble.
Okay.
And it goes, and I've been saved by a woman. It's a magnificent song. I just love that song, Saved by a Woman. And another end, of course, is the whole Christian mythology about Eve. You know, when Eve brought in all our woe, and then Mary gave her fiat, which allowed God to be born, you know. So there's something about that too. But also in a very real way, and thank you, I appreciate that you're talking about, you know, I should be acknowledging my own self-salvation.
Absolutely.
But honestly, like this woman, it feels like I couldn't have reached my self-salvation, if that's the thing, without Ruth. And so it felt entirely appropriate that I would say that. Now, can I just say, and thanks for the question, but I know that my brother Paul has to go at 9 o'clock. Are you still there, Paul? Is he gone? I don't know. Is he still there?
No, he's still there.
He's still there. So I really want Paul to hear this song. So can we go to the next song?
Absolutely. I was just going to ask you if you wanted to introduce it. And I did want to say before we do that the reason I've been picking, people haven't realized, the reason I've been picking these people to ask questions is that they've been dropping questions into the Q&A box.
Thank you. So it just about a bit. So this song hasn't been heard in public yet. The other song was released a few months ago, Every Moment. But this song is a song, Andrea, are you, can people see you again? I can see you, but I don't know whether other people can see you. So Andrea came up with this magnificent melody, and we came up with a version of the song 2 years ago. And then we got Brian involved, and the three of us put everything, you know, it all went through the creative machine again. And we came up with a very new and different version of the song. I'm not going to say any more about it. I already love it. And I hope I'm not in books of tears at the end of it. Okay, here we go.
Built myself a house of glass, searching for the divine. Thought I don't need anyone else, I've got God on my side. Freedom, money, or love, they could never be mine. Deep inside my heart I knew I was living a lie. Happiness started when I first went with you. Ruthie, words can't say all that you mean to me. My Ruthie is so glad I married you. You took me as I am, accepted all of me, glad I asked, so happy you said I do. Broke free from that house of glass, took control of my life. Then one day I saw your face, I needed you by my side. Freedom and the riches of love, these could be yours and mine. From deep inside my heart I asked, would you be my bride? Happiness started when I first went with you. Ruthie, words can't say all that you mean to me. So glad I married you. You took me as I am, accepted all of me. Glad I asked, so happy you said I do. I love you forever. just went with you. Ruthie, words can't say all that you mean to me. My Ruthie, so glad I married you. You took me as I am, accepted all of me. Glad I asked, so happy you said I do. Glad I asked, so happy you said I do. So glad I asked, so happy you said I do.
Oh! Thank
you. Wonderful.
How are you feeling, Joe?
I'm feeling, I felt emotional. Yes, I felt emotional. I love that song. I love the words. I love Brian's voice in it. Mm. I love the melody, which is all down to Andrea.
You've long been a creator, Joe. You made a radio documentary, it must be a decade ago at least. Books, articles, and the creative element to ceremonies. I mean, the music element is something that's relatively recent for you in the last year or two, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, how satisfying is it hearing not just this song, but every moment set to music, set very beautifully to music, and realizing that that's your words you're hearing? Is it the same buzz you got when you heard the professional actors reading your stuff 4 decades ago?
Yes, it is. You know, I mean, listen to Brian singing that song. It just moves me. And again, it's, you know, as a writer, when you express in words a feeling, a truth, a love, you know, I should have said, by the way, like this second book, it's a love story. And while I was like, Andrea and I, we've been writing music for 2 or 3 years. Am I right? About 2 years anyway.
And
I thought it was a new venture for me. And then it was literally only when I was researching the second memoir that I discovered I'd written that song 30 something years ago. You know, I'd forgotten about it, totally forgotten about it. Without the book, it would never have seen the light of day, because I wouldn't have known it existed. And if I hadn't been religious, and if I hadn't spent so much of my life in religion, I think I would have spent it in music. Because I genuinely believe that music has an ability to do what religion is meant to do. And like maybe what it does for lots of people. And like what's still beautiful about religion is very often the music. I love Gregorian chant. I think it's gorgeous. I know some people don't like it, but I think it's gorgeous.
Well, a lot of people here tonight will remember, I'm almost certain it was Nick who said to me that you don't have to be a religious person to appreciate the glory of Handel's Messiah. You know,
it's true.
You can appreciate that on a number of different, just on a different level.
Who's that?
Eamon, it's Aethna here.
Oh, Aethna, how are you doing?
Hi, Aethna, how are you? I can't see you, but I can hear you.
All right, don't worry, I can see you, Joe.
That is good. Is that Bernard McCulligan talking out loud? Is that Bernard McCulligan interrupting everybody else?
It was.
Sorry, Aethna, resume. And Bernie, you could talk then.
Well, I was very, very taken by what John said.
Mm.
Because I'm thinking in terms, I have 2 grown-up children. And what you're writing about, Joe, is a planet they know nothing about. And John very rightly said, this book will speak to those of us who were brought up in that cultural, social world where our parents assumed they were doing the right thing. So I equally had an extremely religious mother who was on her knees, who spent her life, lived most of her life with MS, and firmly believed that this was the Valley of Tears and she was going to get her reward in the next life. And I hope to Christ she did. But what has kind of upset me is the idea that any person, and I'm not, you know, Joe, you're obviously have put your heart on your sleeve and you have given yourself out there for people to listen to. But that anybody, and I can understand it coming from where I come, would feel that they would need somebody else to save them. Somebody else, like I'm thinking of my grown-up children for whom sex and sexuality, basically we originate from sex, okay? That's the only way we got here. And for any religion to actually take that, as they have done in the Catholic Church and most of it, and say that this is it's the worst sin ever, surely. I mean, growing up for me, it was you could always go to confession and say you were sorry and you'd go straight to heaven. But yeah, but my point is that the genesis of people is the fusion. Like I'm not a scientist, so I can't give you I'll give you the emotive and the emotional version of it. But the idea that somebody like yourself would have gone into 8-9 years, was it, with the Marists, where you must sublimate your absolute natural passion, which would be, do I look for somebody in my life to make me feel whole? You know, maybe that is the way society has decided we're all going to pair off and produce more progeny and, you know, that's it, etc. But it's like, that's the one part that my children look at the religion that, you know, of yesteryear and say, how could anybody say that sex is wrong or that the pleasure of sex is wrong? You know, so I just that struck me when John spoke. So thank you, John. And that's what I've responded to. So well done, Joe. You're doing a fantastic job.
Thank you, Etna. And thank you again, John.
Yeah, thank you, Etna. And Eileen, did you want to say something? I noticed you muted yourself as well. Sorry, unmuted yourself. No, I know that also Breed. Thank you for.
Sorry, Berna does. Berna would like to speak, not me. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Luckily enough, Eileen and I can't see each other, but I'm a friend of Ruth, Eileen and myself.
You're a friend of me too.
Yes, well, exactly. But we met Newhall and you made reference to that. So thank you for that. And Joe, I just want to thank you because we love Ruth to bits. Right. And thank you for making her so happy because the two of you are really one big union and it's really, really lovely. I think I might be the only Northern Ireland voice here tonight. And as a practicing Catholic, still practicing Catholic, is that the one thing that I have come to realize that there's a difference between the Catholic Church and the Catholic faith. I believe in the Catholic faith. But I have no time for the Catholic Church. And it saddens me a little, Joe, that the fact that, and I do believe that you have a great belief and you could have given so much to the Catholic Church because that's who you are. And it saddens me a little that you've rejected God when I think you should have rejected the Catholic Church. Mm. And I think if you'd believed in your Catholic faith, not the Catholic Church, I think you'd have been a happier person. And the Catholic Church says, no, men cannot marry. I am totally against that. I go to Mass on a Sunday and I still think it's totally wrong because I think that should be a personal choice. And I think that the Catholic Church has actually lost out in losing you because I think you would have been fantastic for the Catholic faith because I do believe, you say you don't believe in God, Joe, I'm sorry, I don't believe that because I do believe a lot what you say comes from God. And therefore, it saddens me when you say, oh, God, who believes in God? And that's a big lie. Yes, a lot of it has been a lie. It's been come from the Catholic Church, not the Catholic Church. And I think that's very different. Did you see them differently? Coming from the North and being a Catholic, we experienced my experience was to be spat in your face, to have had stones thrown at you because you were Catholic. That's sad. But do you know something? It's no big deal because at the end of the day, that's nothing in comparison to what other people have gone to, like the famine, what people went through before. That's nothing for me. But I think it's really sad that you've lost God because I do believe there's something in you actually is quite godly and you could have given so much for a lot of people to have hope for the future.
Yeah, well, Berna, thank you so much for that contribution. And I really appreciate, you know, having you here because I know you're practicing Catholic and a wonderful person. And this is the thing, like, so I'm thinking, Paul Toomey died not long ago, and he was like a foster father to me. And he cried, like, in recent years, hoping that I would return to the faith. So, you know, I love you, Berna. I love Paul. For me, I don't believe in God. I don't feel any need to believe in God. I find it utterly extraordinary that any of us is alive, that life exists on earth. I don't have to, you know, think it came from a God. Like, evolution is utterly astounding. A sunset is no less wonderful to an atheist than to a believer. And that sense of awe and wonder is so much a part of religion, but it's also so much a part of being human.
Can I just say, do you never think to yourself, when you look at, like, the Aztecs, and then you look at, you go across the world thousands of years ago, and they all had this concept of a greater being?
Yeah.
Do you not think to yourself, well, they're...
Well, they also thought that the earth was flat. Do you know?
Well, some people today still think that.
Indeed, some people today still do, and some people are going to vote for Trump. You know?
Oh, my God. I know, there's a frightening concept.
And let's face it, those who believed in a sun god, to my mind, made a lot more sense than a lot of the other mainstream religions around today. Because at least the sun exists.
Joe, just to... Not that I'm particularly keen to stop the conversation or anything, but or move on, but there are just three people I think are trying to come in to ask questions. I'll ask Adrian Stannard if he wants to unmute himself.
Oh, hello. Am I on?
You are.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I was in sort of introduced to you very recently, Joe, through Brian. So I'm a friend of Brian's.
Ah. So, hello, Adrian. You're very welcome. Like thank you for being here.
Hello, and congratulations on your launch. So I feel like a gatecrasher.
No, you're not. Not at all.
A long time ago, I read some James Joyce, in particular, Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man.
Great book.
And I just sort of felt, it seems like there's some parallels between himself and you.
There are.
And you know, the impact of a woman. You know, on changing his perspective or helping him to awaken his perspective, as it were. So, I mean, did you find yourself being influenced by that when you're...
Utterly, yeah. I love, I mean, Joyce, me and Joyce, we have a thing going on together, you know. I remember, because I did English at uni, and I remember, you know, without having read a word of Joyce, being kind of, you know, it was kind of... with awe, this sense of, oh, he's very difficult and all that kind of stuff, and oh, you won't understand him and all. And then I opened up the first line of A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man. It goes something like, I can't remember, of course, but it goes something like, you know, baby taku. It's baby language. And yeah, I thought, I'm into this. This is good. I understand what this guy is on about. There are scenes, honest to God, there are scenes in that story which have happened in my life. And I have a passage in the first memoir where I'm deciding to take leave of absence, and I'm living at the time in CUS, and emotionally and intellectually I have left. I'm still physically there. I haven't made the full decision yet. And there's this scene where I'm walking along in Dublin, along Leeson Street, and there are two priests wearing everything. I bet they had black underpants. I mean, they have everything, the collar, you name it. But these guys were just pristine. They were just like a mask walking along there, you know. So I walk one direction and they're walking the other direction. And they're probably thinking they understand the world. And I'm thinking, no, they don't. And I'm literally walking the opposite direction, right? And like, it was a metaphor for what was going on in my life. But this is the very same scene in Portrait of the Artist, where there's this troop of Christian brothers walking across the bridge to Dollymount, and he's going the opposite way, and he's saying something like, I will forge in the smithy of my soul the uncreated consciousness of my race. And and he's leaving behind faith and fatherland and something else I can't remember, but yeah, I really identify with Joyce.
Yeah, because of course he had to go into exile, didn't he?
Yeah, thank you, Adrian.
I see that PJ has his hand up. Before we go to PJ, I just want to check that Tricia Lynham, were you trying to to get in there, or am I just misinterpreting the fact that you've unmuted yourself? Speak up there if you wish.
No, hi Joe. Congratulations on your books.
Thank you. Oh, Patricia, I can't see you, so I'm at a loss. I'm told. So I was thinking, who's Patricia? Because I still think of you as Patricia Toomey. You see.
Toomey, I know. Yeah, I know. Yeah.
I mentioned your daddy earlier. I don't know if you were here when I mentioned your daddy.
Oh, I was. Yeah, I was indeed. Yeah. As you know, Joe, my parents were very religious, and I never was, and I always had issue. Growing up, I questioned everybody on religion. I never believed a thing, as you know. And then I tried to get into religion, and I used to go to these prayer meetings and what have you, and just, no, I don't do God, as you know now. But I do agree with the your friends from Northern Ireland. I do think there is a higher power, but I just don't do religion. But, Joe, the question, the thing I have to say to both you and Ruth is, I get saved by a woman. I get that Ruth helped you save yourself. Hmm. I get your relationship, the most wonderful relationship ever. And how am I going to put this? I do think what John said was right in so far as the title and the way it's read. I just get what you mean by it. Yeah. And I think it's the perfect name for the book, because I understand you and what you're saying by it.
Thank you, Patricia. And
as I said, wonderful books. Congrats.
Thank you. Thank you, Patricia. Patricia refers to me as her brother.
Her brother,
From another mother.
Yeah.
And that's because, you know, I didn't have a happy relationship with my mother, and the Toomeys adopted me as their own. And when I left the Maris, did I go home? No, I didn't. I moved in with the Toomeys. Got a second family. It's great.
That would be my big bro anyway.
Thank you.
Thanks, Patricia. I think that PJ is the only one left trying to get in. So PJ, if you want to unmute yourself we might wrap up after that.
Thanks, Eamon. Okay, Joe, for as long as I've known you, you always had a tailpiece on your emails, and it includes those two lines, and I'd love you to explain them to me. The greatest omission in life is to risk nothing. The person who risks nothing gets nothing, has nothing, and is nothing. Surely that can't be the case. No, that's my own piece.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. But I love it. That is literally my favorite quote, because it's not, you know, you're focusing on the is nothing bit, which is clearly not the case. But the part of it that I love is about the person who risks nothing. Because I think a lot of my life I spent choosing safety. You know, it seems safer in the Marists than out there in the big world. I had a university professor in history who I talked to him, and I remember he saying, take your chance in the world. And I was afraid to take my chance in the world, but his exhortation struck, you know, take your chance in the world. And, you know, that image of the procrastinator on the fence, and I was so often on that fence and so often returning to my habitual field, but not being satisfied with it. And then I'm back up on the fence. And the worry was always, it might hurt. You know, there might be barbed wire in the long grass and I might hurt myself. And that's why I love that quote, because it resonates with my experience of taking a risk, abandoning safety, you know, a calculated risk, and jumping into life. So I love that quote. But I accept, yeah, that element of it isn't the best, but the one of jumping into life, I love it.
Yeah, thanks, PJ. And thank you, everybody, for attending this evening. I've really enjoyed it. I have no doubt that Joe enjoyed it.
May I ask one thing? If you do read the book, may I please ask you to do a review on Amazon or on goodreads.com? Because even if it's only a one-line review, you know, two lines, three lines, it doesn't matter. It helps the book. So if you've read it, if you like it, give me 5 stars and say something nice about it. It really does help the book. And Maureen Potter was a comedian whom perhaps some of you are far too young to remember or to know, but she used to do a panto every year. We used to go to it. And she used to always finish her panto asking people to tell, you know, if they liked it, tell everyone. And if you didn't like it, keep your breath to cool your porridge. So please do a review. And if you don't like it, keep your breath to cool your porridge. Thank you very much. Listen, can I say, I want to thank Eamon for, I think of him, I'm sorry about this, Eamon, if you find it, I think of him as a midwife, that he has kind of brought this book into, and he did such a wonderful job last time that, you know, and encouraged me to write the second book, and then chaired this one no less magnificently. He is a great encourager. And I guess, you know, the talk and that brilliant question that John O'Sullivan asked about Saved by a Woman, and is sort of self-denigrating to say that. You know, maybe when you're a creative person like I am and a writer, you do have a pretty low self-esteem, and you kind of need people to encourage you. So that's why I'm asking y'all to do reviews of my book. But you kind of need people to egg you on, and Eamon is one such person. And I also want to thank, I'm so sorry that Brian Matthews couldn't be here, our singer. As I mentioned, you might have missed it earlier, his wife is ill. She had acute pain today, and he had to contact me just about an hour before we went live saying that he was still at the hospital and he couldn't be here. So it would be great. Thank you for that. And I want to thank Andrea. So where's Andrea? There's Andrea with the trumpet. Hold your trumpet in the air again, please, Andrea, if you still have it. It is a total joy to me to work with Andrea, and such a wonderful musician, and with Brian. So do please, if you're on Spotify, your patron Andrea, but go on and like his music, and give him a like, give him a play, and likewise with The Rain, R-A-Y-N-E. I have to mention me missus, because, you know, her mug is on the front of her beautiful, beautiful face.
Yes, you know, lovely.
Isn't it gorgeous? Hello, Berna. I'm seeing Berna for the first time now tonight. Mm. But thank you. Isn't it gorgeous? Isn't she gorgeous?
Yeah, she is.
And in fact, Berna, I think you were with her when this photograph was taken. You were off on some Greek island.
Yeah.
Off with girls. And because I'm also talking about this, can I just say, Paul Holm is there. Hello, Paul. Can you sort of wave yourself? Because Paul is another musician that I collaborate with. And so it's just I think music is where it's at. And I want to thank each and every one of you for being here. It really means a lot. I thank you, those of you who spoke, those of you who didn't, those of you who went to the trouble to be here. Those of you, it doesn't matter whether you buy the book or not, it won't make me much richer either way. But if you read the book, you can order the library or something, get them to buy it. And if you do a little review, please, because it'll help. Last thought, I thought I have to leave them all with a little nugget. And my last little nugget is, and I hope this sort of connects with what Berna was saying earlier, you know, love is all around us. And I feel loved tonight. So love is all around us. And I know there are times in our life when we feel love isn't around us, but love is all around us. And I'm feeling the love tonight. So I want to thank you for your love.
That was lovely. Thank you, Joe. That was lovely.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. Well done, Joe.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.